concerns regarding the personality development. Of course, my life story is somewhat unusual. My life story brought me from the very solid scientific background to yoga and to Vedic philosophy. But I will combine these two in this lecture. I will be speaking on a very strict scientific basis, but at the same time, I will introduce certain concepts which, in my opinion, are very relevant to our life today and which can solve many of our problems and which are taken from very ancient ideas of yoga and Vedic philosophy. If you don't mind, I will work according to this a little short outline. So, first of all, I wanted to present to you certain experiments and ideas from a completely modern scientific background, and then explain how yoga gives the key to solve certain problems. I will try to use the board as little as possible because there is no mic there. Okay, the first thing which I wanted to talk about is the phenomenon of so-called deferred gratification. This is a very crucial experiment which was done in Stanford University by one Daniel Michael in the 60s of the 20th century. And his experiment is very, very important and very simple. He took some 4-year-old children and he gave them some sweet. This experiment is called marshmallow experiment. And he told them, please wait for 20 minutes, and if you wait for 20 minutes before eating this sweet, you will get another sweet. So naturally, most of the children just ate this one. And some children, they waited for 20 minutes and got the second one. So what they did with this group of 4-year-old children, they tracked their career for 20 years. And the amazing result which they got after 20 years of experiment is that those people who could wait for 20 minutes when they were 4 years old were much higher in all their achievement than those who couldn't wait. Basically, they were in their scholastic aptitude test, they were 210 points in average higher than the children who couldn't wait. And so many other, you know, tests that were done to really define what is there. So this is the first experiment, and there is the whole range of this kind of experiments which shows that there is a certain ability in man, ability to control their impulses. Instead of instant gratification, to control their impulses and to delay the gratification. And this ability to delay gratification ultimately is a key to success. We're all talking about personality development, and personality development means to achieve some success, right? And success basically leads us to happiness. So there is a very important point which I want to make, is that there is a certain ability which we have or not have, which may be developed or which may not be developed, or developed to a certain extent. Thank you.
Let's hope.
So, this is the first thing which I wanted to tell. The second thing, and actually, this experiment led to develop the concept of emotional intelligence. This is another concept or another very modern term in psychology, which basically means that besides the intelligence as we usually know, the intelligence as ability to manipulate certain information and to somehow or other to make some conclusions, there is emotional intelligence. And this emotional intelligence, you don't see anything, right? So, this emotional intelligence is basically, it consists of four factors, and one of them is self-management or self-control. And again, the author, Goleman, who developed this emotional intelligence concept, he shows that people who are capable for this emotional intelligence or who are gifted with emotional intelligence are much more successful in many, many areas of their life. And he proves that emotional intelligence is an important factor for our development. And the third concept, which I also want to introduce before I speak how yoga solves this problem, is perhaps you may have heard about Stephen Covey. Again, he is one of the most important management gurus in America, modern management gurus, and his concept is called Seven Habits of Highly Effective People. Seven Habits. Again, by using a lot of experimental data, Stephen Covey shows what traits in our personality ensure our success in life, in many different areas in life. And his first habit, the very first habit about he talks, is called proactivity. And by proactivity, he means the ability, human ability, to control our impulses and to use our impulses in accordance with our values, to bring our values and our impulses into some coherent unity. So, basically, I just gave these three quite different examples which show one certain point, which is the key point, and which is the key point in yoga as well. That the ability for self-control is a very essential one, essential ability, for the development of personality. Basically, you cannot achieve anything unless you develop this certain point. But the problem with all these concepts, of course, Stephen Covey gives some hints how to develop this ability. But as far as the Goleman or Mr. Michael, who talked about delayed gratification, they all somewhat baffled. They say it's a gift. It's either there or not there. So ultimately, it's of no relevance for us if we say that it's either there or not there. But it so happens that yoga talks about this in great depth, and yoga makes a point that this particular ability can be developed and should be developed in any human being. As much as all these scientists or management gurus or whatever, as much as they stress this ability, yoga, thousands of years before, already knew that this ability is crucial for our self-development, for our personality development, and not only stress this point, but also develop some technique how we can basically develop this ability in us. So if you want to hear what are the yoga solution for this, we can go on with this. Are you interested? Or not?
Yes.
Okay. I'm just checking. Let me see. Unless I miss something. Okay. So what I will do now, I will introduce certain principles which are formulated in a little coward way, not exactly in a very scientific way, in Yoga Sutras of Patanjali. And I will try to shed the scientific light into these principles. And moreover, I will explain how to use this in our day-to-day life. Basically, yoga insists that mind is an instrument, it's a tool. And it's a very peculiar tool because mind has certain degree of independence. Usually, when we talk about the tool, tools don't have independence, unless we talk about Windows. Windows have some degree of independence in PC, but it's a joke. Ultimately, if we're talking about tools, whether it's a computer, whether it's this microphone, whether it's a hammer, they don't have any independence. You know, if the tool would have any independence, it would be very counterproductive. But our mind is a tool. In Sanskrit, mind is called antahkarana, which basically means internal tool or internal instrument. But this particular tool has certain degree of independence. It does not really, you know, so easily controlled. It's not easily controlled. For example, if you get angry, can you tell the mind, stop being angry? You can tell, but it won't work. No. If the mind gets some idea, if the mind is agitated, if somebody told you something which really offended you, which really pierced your heart, you know, can you cool the mind and say, please be quiet, I have some other business to do? No, for 2 months you're just thinking about some stupid words which somebody told you. You know, and that's the problem. That's a problem which human beings are trying to solve for years, for centuries, for millennia. You know, for example, my hands are also a tool. My tongue is a tool. But let's say that tongue has a certain degree of independence. And he wants to speak something which I don't want to speak. You know, it would be very embarrassing. I'm standing in front of you and my tongue is doing something. Or for example, I'm here in front of you and my legs all of a sudden start walking somewhere. And I'm saying, goodbye. You know, when my legs want to come back, I will come. So, but this is the problem with the mind. Because with the mind is not so easily controlled. So this question of how to control the mind, what are the techniques to control the mind, is extremely essential. And basically, the ability of people to control the mind is tantamount to their ability to develop themselves, to progress in life. As much as I can control my mind, as much I can solve the very complicated questions, as much as I am enslaved by my mind, as much as I am more or less controlled by my mind, I am helpless. And in fact, this issue or this problem of being controlled by the mind is the main, the key problem which yoga is trying to solve. And which Vedic philosophy or ancient Indian philosophy is trying to solve. And in fact, any philosophy is trying to solve. If we take Pythagoras or Socrates, this is again the main issue which they're trying to tackle. So, what I want to introduce now, a Vedic understanding of mind, which will have, or yoga understanding of mind, which will have a very profound implications, which will explain to us how to deal with the mind and what is this stuff which is very difficult to control. Basically, if we talk about yoga, concept of mind has five very important points, which is easy to comprehend. Okay. The first point about the mind is the mind, according to yoga, is malleable. You know this word, right? Of pliable. This is the first thing which is very important to understand, that the mind gets the impression from the environment very easily. And the mind, being pliable, can change its shape. The second point, our internal mood, internal state, our ability to solve certain problems, our ability to resist the challenging environment, so on and so forth, very much depends on the form of the mind. The form of the mind determines a lot, basically. So, the mind is pliable. It means that certain influences can change the shape of the mind. And the form of the mind, or the shape of the mind, is very essential for our internal development and our ability to answer the challenges. The third point is the most crucial. There are four factors which influence the mind the most. Environment, our upbringing, our karma, or our past actions, which left certain impressions in our mind, and our actions. This is the four crucial factors which determines the shape of the mind, which basically influence the mind the most. Of course, you know, they more or less encompass all different factors which are there, but we will concentrate on certain things. We will not concentrate on karma or even actions, but we will concentrate on the first two. The fourth point is that basically you can change your mind and more or less become happy. And the fifth point I will not tell now. This I will tell at the end, if you remind me. So this is the four simple points. But behind these simple points lies a very important wisdom, which I wanted to share with you. So what yoga tells us is that you can change your mind basically by changing your environment. Let me explain this first. We don't really understand how much environment influences us, how much information we get, and how this information is actually negatively influences us. The ancient Vedic culture was very protective for the mind, and the modern culture is totally contrary to this. It's not at all protective to the mind. You know, the mind is constantly being bombarded by certain impulses which ultimately agitate the mind and bring the mind into a certain shape which is not very productive to real functioning of the mind. The next thing which I wanted to say is that the real nature of the mind, according to yoga, is sattva. In fact, sattva is the synonym for mind in Sanskrit.
Sattva basically means certain. Sattva is the mode which produces the mind, and this is the real nature of the mind itself. And if the sattva is predominant in the mind is functioning properly. And if the sattva is lacking in the mind is not really functioning properly. This statement I want also to back by some scientific research. The mind takes the external influences, and these external influences, they build certain energy. I don't know how elaborately I should explain about, you know the concept of three gunas, of sattva, rajas and tamas, or not? Okay, let me explain it from a scientific point of view. If you take anything which you want to describe, there are three basic characteristics in any object. One is mass. Another one is energy. And another one is structure. So mass is the very gross characteristic of any object which we take. Energy is much more subtle, and the structure is even more subtle. And these three characteristics which are there, which are basic for any object which we take, these three characteristics is very much correspond to the ancient Vedic concept of tamas, which basically means inertia, ignorance, sleep, rajas, which means energy, and sattva. So these three modes of nature correspond very much to mass, energy, and structure. And what I want to stress very much in this little presentation is that this third characteristic, which is there, sattva, is extremely essential. If we take any object, then the value of this object is determined by its mass, by its energy, but most of all, by its structure. For example, this computer. Why is it valuable? Because it has a very elaborate and developed structure. If we take some coal and we take diamond, what is the difference between coal and diamond?
Structure.
Yeah, only structure, right? Coal is carbon and diamond is carbon. But what is more valuable? You know, if you take a lot of coal and a little small diamond, what is more valuable? Of course, diamond is more valuable. Why? Because it's highly structured. Because it has very high order, high level of structure. So the ancient Vedic wisdom talks about this. It says that these certain traits, certain characteristic traits, energy, mass, and structure, are there in every object, including our mind. And this is our main subject matter which we are discussing today. That what should be the most important thing in our mind, how to develop our mind. Basically, what I want to say is that we have to develop our mind into the direction of sattva. Because, after all, this is the nature of the mind anyway. And if the tamas and rajas predominated in our mind, and the modern environment is basically stressing very much this lower qualities, and sattva is very much reduced in our environment. So basically, we are preparing ourselves to catastrophe. We are preparing ourselves to a very bad end. And this is basically the conclusion of Vedic scriptures. Let me explain it from some other point of view. In Bhagavad Gita, this concept of three energies, three basic energies which are there in the nature, is very elaborately and in a very great detail is explained there. And it's a very interesting concept to understand how this world works. When I just started using computer, there was a very difficult operational system which was called MS-DOS. Is there any one of you who was using MS-DOS? A few. So, but it was very quickly replaced by what? Yeah, by Windows. What is the difference between MS-DOS and Windows? You know, there is a graphical system, right? Windows is a graphical system, and it's very easy. Even a child can use the graphical system. He just pushes the button, you know, and you know what happens. So, what I want to say by explaining this concept is that this concept, which is there in Bhagavad Gita, in Vedic literature, is a very profound concept, which is very much similar to graphical operational system. The modern system is trying to explain the world in a very complicated terms. You know, if you take any subject, it's very specialized, chemistry, physics, nobody knows what's going on. He knows only a very narrow area of his own research. But what is explained in Vedic scriptures? In Vedic scriptures, there is a picture of the world which is explained in a graphical way, in a very understandable way, in a very simple way. So simple that even a child can use this system. Even a child can understand the concept or difference between sattva, rajas and tamas. In Bhagavad Gita, Krishna explains what it is. You know, tamas means inertia, laziness, sleep, drowsiness, all these conditions which are there in the mind, and you can easily see them in the environment. And, you know, when there's rajas, rajas means passion, desires, desire to enjoy, and it's very beautiful, but at the end, it has a very bad end. It's suffering at the end. And sattva means peacefulness. Sattva means that you are very clear, you're not confused, you're very straightforward. Sattva means certain qualities. So what I want to say is that Vedic scriptures, they present very comprehensive picture of the world, which is easily usable. If you know this concept and you know what is the result, what is the end result of this concept, you can easily manage your life. What Vedas say, if your mind is sattvic, you can control yourself. And if your mind is very much rajasic, if there is a lot of, you know, passions in your mind, there is no chance for you to control your mind. And if your mind is very much tamasic, if it's really down, if it's kind of lazy and drowsy, you know, then there is no chance for happiness. And in other words, what I want to stress here is that if we have sattvic mind, then this sattvic mind fulfills the first condition which I formulated. The sattvic mind can be controlled. The sattvic mind means controlled mind. The rajasic mind means the mind which is totally out of control, and tamasic mind is the mind which is, you know, which doesn't know what to do at all. In yoga, there is a concept of five states of mind. Very soon it will become very practical. I will just introduce you certain concepts, and then I will explain how it works. In yoga, it is said that the mind has five states, which is very much relevant to our internal development. The first state is called Kshipta. The second state is called Mudha. The third state is called Vikshipta. The fourth state is called Ekagra. And the fifth state is called Niruddha. So, this is the state where rajas and tamas, lower modes of nature, dominate in our mind. And the person with this state of mind, he's very restless. He cannot concentrate on anything. He's just jumping from one idea to another. You know, he's sitting in front of the TV. He's changing the channels every 3 seconds. If he's browsing on the internet, he's changing the sites every 5 seconds or something like this. So this is the mind which is totally out of control, because these two energies, tamas and rajas, are dominating in the mind, and that makes mind totally, completely uncontrolled. So what happens if you are in this state, and of course all the drugs and everything, they basically stimulate this condition of our mind. If we overuse different stimulus like Coca-Cola and alcohol and everything, this is basically what we are preparing ourselves. We are preparing ourselves to have certain shape of the mind which is totally out of control. So what happens after this agitated mind, which is jumping, which cannot concentrate, it goes into the mode of tamas, and that's called muda. Muda, when the tamas is predominant in the mind. You're just lazy, you're lethargic, you're apathetic, you don't have any energy to do, and basically that means depression. We can see how people who are very agitated, who are using or overusing different stimulus, they preparing themselves into a deep depression. And this depression is a very deep disease. Basically, all the suicides are being committed, or most of the suicides are being committed in the state of depression. It's a certain shape of the mind which we created ourselves. We have to be very clear about this, that we are preparing ourselves for certain future. And we are preparing it by influencing our mind in a certain way. So if these lower qualities of material nature take over our mind, nothing good is going to happen. So the third state of mind is a state when the rajas, or the passion, is very predominant in the mind. This is the state which is very much prominent in business people, in achievers, so to speak. And it's not bad in one sense, because rajas gives you a lot of determination, a lot of energy. The only problem is that it's prone to deteriorate into tamas. It has a very clear direction, but sometimes this direction doesn't know the goal. There is a lot of energy, but the goal is usually misplaced. The goal is sense gratification, and this sense gratification, of course, gives some certain illusion of happiness, but ultimately, people who are overusing this energy of rajas, they are frustrated. We can see this. I have many passionate friends who are there, and sometimes they get into, again, deep depression. So that's the problem with this, and according to Ayurveda and according to yoga, these three states of mind are dosha. It's a defect for the mind. These lower modes of material nature, when they influence the mind, they are preparing the mind into a very unhealthy condition. Ultimately, this is not a very healthy condition for the mind. So, what is stated very clearly in yoga, that the sattvic mind, the mind where sattva is predominant, is called ekagra, and ekagra basically means the controlled mind. The mind, or concentrated mind. The mind which can be controlled, or which can be at least directed in a very clear way. And of course, the highest state is above sattva, and it's completely controlled mind. We are not talking about this state now because it's too high. But at least this stage is extremely essential for our self-development. We have to really understand that it's energy of sattva which brings mind under control and which develops the mind in a healthy way. So, I want to tell you some little experiment again. This experiment was done by one amateur scientist and it was awarded by the National Academy of Science in America. He took some mice and they were doing certain, you know, tasks going through this, how do you call it?
Maze.
So he took the control group of mice and he took the poor mice whom he basically put some hard rock music to them. And you know, for 1 week the mice was listening hard rock music. So the average ability of the mice to go through the maze was 10 minutes. After listening the hard music, the hard rock music, they decreased this time or increased this time up to 30 minutes. And the normal mice, they would learn very quickly and they would reduce this time more and more. Whereas these mice who were exposed to this hard rock music, they were more slow and slow and slow, and their ability to learn was reducing more and more and more. What I want to say is that this is one of the little examples how certain environmental impulses from outside influence our mind. Basically, there are certain things which influence our mind very much. As I said, the mind very much depends on this external environment, and if we arrange our environment in a very sattvic way, in a way which is conducive to promote peacefulness and certain things, then our mind is much more healthy, in a much more healthier state. So the Vedic scriptures say that there are certain things which are very important to influence the mind. The number one is, of course, food, and especially drink. It's very interesting that the Vedic scripture stress that the drink or liquids, they immediately influence our mind. We know, if you take alcohol, does it influence your mind? Very much so. Did you try? Okay, I will not ask you. The point is that it's very simple. You know, if it's something liquid, the liquid goes directly to the mind. And in Upanishads, in Chandogya Upanishad in particular, it is said that, you know, 1/3 of the food goes directly to the mind. It is said that the food or drink is divided into 3 parts. And 1/3 goes to the body, to build the body. 1/3 goes to waste. It just comes out. And 1/3 goes directly to the mind. I mean, it may not be scientifically exact that 1/3, 1/3, 1/3, but the idea is very clear. What I want to say is that certain influences, and specifically food, and especially drink, they influence directly mind. You know, the modern concept, it's a very gross concept. I was studying biochemistry and molecular biology, and of course in molecular biology or modern medicine, they mostly study or investigate the influences of the food upon your body. Hardly anyone investigates the influences of the food upon your mind. But this is much more important because the mind in turn influences the whole body. From the strictly nutritional point of view, the food may be okay from the body. But we because it carries certain energy to the mind. It influences the mind, and the mind in turn influences the body in a negative way. So, what is very important to understand is that food influences, first of all, first and foremost, our mind. And if the food is sattvic, we will ensure that the sattvic energy will be dominant in our mind. If the food is not sattvic, if the food is rajasic, then the rajasic energy will be predominant in our mind. And ultimately our mind will be out of control. The same with music. The same with the smells. The same with the touch. Every information which we get from outside carries certain energy. And the simple message which yoga gives is that whatever energy it carries inside stays inside. And staying inside influences the whole psyche of a human being, and by influencing the psyche of a human being, it influences his whole life. So the first thing which we have to really understand, one has to really regulate the environment and make the environment very protective. What I want to say is that initially, if we study Vedic scriptures, Dharma Shastras or whatever, we can see very much that the stress is given to protect the mind. We are dealing now with the culture which cannot care less about protecting the mind, which is destroying mind by all this TV, by all this, you know, all this agitations which are constantly there. People are totally mindless about these things, about these influences. But these subtle influences, they may sound very innocent in the beginning. Or they may be, or they may feel very innocent in the beginning. But they have tremendous impact in our mind. So, this is the first thing which I wanted to explain to you by this simple concept, that we have to be very protective of our mind, and we have to create the environment. That I said that, ahar basically means food, as you know. But ahar means whatever we take inside. Literally, if we translate the word ahara from Sanskrit, it means whatever we take inside. And it doesn't mean only by our tongue. By our eyes, we can also take something inside. By our nose, we can take something inside. And by our ears, we can take something inside. And whatever we take inside, if it carries the negative energy, this negative energy will ultimately influence our mind and influences the whole life and the whole environment of us. This is one thing. But Vedic scriptures say another very interesting thing. They say kala is another influence upon the mind. Kala means, of course, you know. What kala means? Time. You know, this concept of three gunas, sattva, rajas, and tamas, is all pervading. Any phenomena which you see around carries certain energy. And time also carries certain energy upon itself. Like, for example, you know, we are approaching evening time. And evening time, what energy does it carry? What usually people do in the evening?
Relax.
If they're lucky, they relax. If they're not lucky, they go to discotheque. You know, there's certain energy within our body which is stimulated by the time. And certain time carries certain energy. And usually people don't go to discotheque at 5 o'clock in the morning. You don't feel like going to discotheque, right? Isn't that all? You don't feel like drinking wine at 5 o'clock in the morning. Why? Because there is certain energy which is there in the environment. The wisdom of Vedic literature is there that we have to really bring us into the harmony with the environment. And we have to use the positive energy which is there in the time, and we have to minimize the negative energy which is there. Therefore, the simple rule to protect the mind and to increase sattva in the mind, and in this way increase the, our ability to control the mind, is to go to bed early and to rise early. There is a nice English saying, early to bed, early to rise makes one healthy, wealthy and wise. They're talking about sattva guna. They're not talking about anything else. They're talking about this simple rule, how the simple rule influences our mind, and how the simple rule influences our whole life, ultimately. Because our mind is us. And whatever our mind is, if our mind is strong, if our mind is clear, if our mind is very structured, then the whole life becomes clear, structured, and very peaceful. So, this is another factor which I wanted to mention, and the influence of the time. It's an extremely important factor, and we should not neglect it. Unfortunately, again, the modern life, especially city life, tends to, you know, people tend to go to bed later and later and later. And I know, I was a student myself, especially before the exam. What you do the night before the exam, usually you study, right? But ultimately, it's not good. Ultimately, this time is useless, and the effect upon the mind is very detrimental. It's much better to rise a little earlier, and of course, you all know that there is Brahma Muhurta time, where the sattvic energy in the environment is the most prominent. So if you rise in this Brahma Muhurta time, you get so much sattvic energy, you get the stability. What happens if the sattva predominates in your mind? If sattvic energy is there, then of course, we do have some influences which would throw us out of balance. You know, sometimes we become angry. And angry basically means a tamasic emotion. But if sattva predominates in the mind, then we get angry, but we very quickly get into back into balance. If these energies are predominant in the mind, then it's very easy to throw us out of the balance, our mind out of the balance, and it's very difficult to get back into balance. So this sattvic influence upon our mind makes us balanced and makes us self-controlled, you know, even if sometimes we feel this. Of course, you know, anyone sometimes feel a little sleepy or sometimes feel a little, you know, too much energetic. Again, if there is certain amount or certain storage of sattva within our mind, it's not a problem. We can go back to balance very easily. And I want to also mention certain other things which are very important in this regard. The third influence which is there upon the mind, which carries a very powerful energy, is of course place. Time, place, food, and there's nothing much to say about this, but of course, if we are in a very serene environment, in a very nice, peaceful environment, that brings some energy of peace within our mind and goes a long way to help us to maintain the mental balance. And the third thing which I want to stress very much is, of course, association. You know, we know that the certain associations, certain people whom we associate with, it increases certain tendencies in us. And these tendencies may or may not be so subtle. So, basically, I wanted to list these simple things and to say that, you know, if we use this, we can manage or we can actually determine our development. The simple concept which I want to introduce now is that development or personality development means to increase sattva in our personality. In our daily life, in our schedule, in our food, in our association, you know, if we're increasing this energy of sattva, we can be sure that we are developing in the right direction. So, I want to say few more words about this concept of self-development according to yoga. We have a certain ability in us. And this ability in us, which distinguishes human being from the lower species of life, is called intelligence, or in Sanskrit it's called buddhi. The concept of personality development or self-development, I said here that it means increasing sattva, and that's very much true. But there is another thing which I wanted to stress very much here, is that also development of this certain ability, which is called buddhi or intelligence, is also extremely important. And this ability in us is the ability to see ourselves from outside, more or less. Yoga speaks about mind or manas and buddhi. And manas is an external reactive mind. The mind which works according to the stimuli. You know, stimuli somehow or other agitates us and the mind reacts. And buddhi means our ability to rationalize and understand what's happening with us. Basically, buddhi means the ability for self-introspection. If we want to really develop our personality, we have to use this ability. In other words, we have to see and mark our development. This concept of sattva gives us clear tool to see how we develop. And self-introspection or self-analysis gives us the understanding of our progress. You know, we basically have to set the goal. I want to set certain goals in my life. By increasing these particular qualities in my own mind. And for this, I have to use very much my self-introspection or self-analysis. Without this self-analysis, my progress in life will not be possible. Because ultimately, this self-analysis gives me the tools how to, you know, to see or to mark my progress. I'm going in a certain direction, whether I'm going or not, whether I'm developing in this direction or not. And this development, this ability in us. Another synonymous word for this buddhi is basically willpower. Because willpower, again, is being developed, and it's being developed gradually according to the extent or the grade of sattva which is there in our mind. But willpower gives us a real understanding of what we should do, what we should not do. And this ability, this simple ability, or this very important ability, not simple, but very important ability, can be developed if we develop, if we set certain goals and achieve these goals. In Vedic culture, there is this concept of vrata. And vrata, if you give certain vow and you fulfill this vow, it ultimately helps you to develop this buddhi, this ability in the mind which is bringing you under the certain control, under the control. So, I don't know for how long more I can talk, I just wanted to give little overview about these things, and I want to, in the conclusion of my little lecture, give some other, give some other idea, which is very much in harmony with the Vedic concept. I was studying psychology for some time, and as you know, there is the father of modern psychology, Sigmund Freud. And he said that the main impetus and the main goal of human life is basically gratification, self-gratification, enjoyment. He said that the main drive in a human being is the drive to enjoy, and this drive to enjoy is epitomized by the sex drive. And therefore Sigmund Freud is so much famous for his psychological investigation of this sex drive and manifestation of sex drive. So, he was in Vienna, and he had another disciple. He had one disciple, Adler, also a very famous psychologist. And he came after Freud, and he said that my teacher was wrong, that the drive for sex or enjoyment is very strong, but much stronger is the drive for power, the drive to have certain status in life, certain position. So that's basically his idea, what is main impetus in human psychology. And then after him came another psychologist, very famous psychologist, Viktor Frankl. He was also a disciple, a student of Sigmund Freud. He rejected Sigmund Freud. For some time he was associating with Adler, but ultimately he rejected Adler. And he said that there is much more important drive in a human being. And this drive is the drive for meaning in life. He developed a very elaborate technique, psychotherapeutic technique, based on this concept. And this technique works wonders. And he proves with a lot of clarity that this drive is the most essential drive for the human being, that every human being wants to have meaning in life, wants to have his life very meaningful. So if we see this concept of three basic energies which are there, we can very much relate these three basic energies or three basic modes of nature to these three psychological theories. If the tamas or lower nature is predominant in our mind, then definitely the main drive in us will be drive for sex. We can see that people who are very low in their development, who are basically underdeveloped, or who behave like animals, for them the main drive is enjoyment. There is nothing else in their life. If you deprive them the enjoyments, you deprive them of their life. You know, if you take people who are very much into position, into achieving some status in life, they're driven by this energy of rajas. And this trait is also there in our psychology. It's a very strong impetus which is there in us. But again, according to The third psychologist, one of the greatest psychologists of the 20th century, Viktor Frankl. You know, the meaning of life, the desire to have meaningful life, a structured life, is also there. And we can very clearly see that this concept of meaningful life is very much correlated with the energy of sattva. And of course, it's up to you to decide what you choose among the three. But what I want to say is that we are human beings and we are born free. And our freedom is basically the freedom to choose between our association. There is not much freedom otherwise, but we can choose what association we want. And the association, including our food, our regimen, and everything else, association will ultimately bring in us or develop in us certain characteristics which are belonging either to tamas or to rajas or to sattva. And depending on our choice, our life will be directed to self-enjoyment. And some people, they view it as a certain kind of development, or personality development, if they can enjoy nicely, if they think that they're successful in life. Rajas will bring us to status, power, to some certain position, but ultimately will bring about frustration in our life, because as Viktor Frankl very aptly said, that if some people are trying to achieve status, sooner or later they will be deprived of this status. They will not be able to maintain this status. No much, doesn't matter how much they are successful in this regard, they will not be able to maintain this status, and the frustration is there. And this is the concept which is there in Bhagavad Gita. Bhagavad Gita says that sense enjoyment doesn't bring any real satisfaction, and it's ultimately not good. It's a depression from the very beginning. It puts you into depression. Rajaguna brings you to frustration. And ultimately, if you obtain the meaning of your life, if you obtain the structure in your life, and you know that there is some meaning which is transcendental to your own being, then you obtain happiness. This very interesting correlation is there in Bhagavad Gita, and this very interesting correlation is ultimately there in the modern psychology. Viktor Frankl, very clearly explains, according to many investigations which he did and his colleagues did, that ultimately if people choose this path of life, they will not achieve ultimate happiness. And this way of life is bringing about the happiness and satisfaction which we all desire and hanker upon. So there are basically three ways of self-development or personality development. But even though superficially we may say that there are three ways, ultimately there is only one way for our development. It's to increase sattva in our life and to increase happiness in this way, increase happiness in our life. So this last thing which I wanted to introduce, I explained about these three ways or three psychological theories. And, you know, by seeing them, you can see very clearly what are choices are there in your life. You know, what is there ahead of you. And, you know, now you are really free to choose. So, what else I wanted to say? I guess that's it.
Thank you. discussion. So if you have any question, you can ask from me.
Is there a point to ask us to remind you about the fifth point when you're talking about yoga?
Fifth point.
The mind.
Thank you for reminding me. The fifth point which yoga speaks about the mind, when yoga explains the mind, yoga says that you can achieve satisfaction. The point number four is that you can achieve, you can change your mind in a positive way. Basically, for that you have to change your life. You have to really protect your mind from the negative influences and develop certain ability or certain traits in your mind. But the fifth point is very interesting. The fifth point says that ultimate satisfaction lies behind the mind. That this happiness which you achieve on this stage, basically, if you change the mind in a positive way, you become happy. You get rid of depression, you get rid of tamas in your mind, you are very peaceful and very structured in your life and in your mind. That's fine. But then, what yoga says, then you use this mind to transcend the mind. Because, again, the very concept of yoga is that ultimate satisfaction lies behind the mind. This is the happiness which you find within the mind, within the boundaries of the mind. But then the yoga says, if you achieve certain stage of mind, when the mind is a very obedient tool in your hands, then you can use the mind to transcend the mind. And go beyond the mind into some other realm where the real happiness is there. This is, of course, not very scientific. Therefore, I didn't want to introduce it from the very beginning. Not very scientific in the sense that it's not within the paradigm of the modern science. But at the same time, you know, we can see that this is quite reasonable. Because ultimately the mind is flickering. And even though you can achieve the happiness within the mind, the real happiness lies beyond the mind, outside of the boundaries of the mind. But you can achieve this state only if you come to the fourth stage.
Sir, being committed to your work passionately, rajasa or sattva?
Being committed to your work can be sattva or can be rajas. It depends what is your motivation. If you do your action in a very beautiful way and you're committed to this, that's sattva. But if you're committed to your work and you have some other goal in mind, see, we can be committed to an action in two different ways. I can be committed to an action, but my main interest lies in the result. And I'm very much committed to the action, but I'm much more interested in the result. And if I can achieve the result without being committed to the action, I will not be committed to the action. Right? If I can achieve my result by some crooked way, then I will abandon the action and I will achieve the result by the crooked way. If I am committed to the result. But if I am really committed to the action itself, that's subtle. And that's basically how you influence your mind in a sattvic way by your actions. I didn't elaborate on this, I only hinted on this. I said that there are four factors which influence your mind very much. I mostly explained environment, but I also said that action is very much important when it comes to the structure of the mind. Or the nature of the mind. So in action, the main portion is motivation. If you are committed to your work as such, and you are doing it for the sake of work, without being so much bothered about the result will be better, and it will very positively influence your mind. Like, for example, Leonardo da Vinci. You know, he was painting this one little painting for 20 years. And he was obviously not very much interested in the final result. If he had 30 more years, he would paint this Mona Lisa for 30 more years. But as a result, what we have something people can't believe. But he was not very passionate, you know. Very passionate, and passion arises, you know, makes us neglect the meticulous action, and we rush towards the result. But if we're really committed to the action, then result will be better, and our mind will be very positively influenced. Yes.
Like, how do you describe the mind of people suffering from psychological disorder?
Psychological disorders.
Like mentally retarded people. How do you describe the mind of these people?
Yeah, and that I can explain this one. So basically, what yoga says is that any action which you do produce certain impressions in your mind, which is called samskaras. And these samskaras in turn influence the mind. What happens, the senses react or interact with the environment, with the the information which the senses bring, they bring to the mind. So when the mind gets this information, he goes to citta, according to yoga. And citta means more or less subconsciousness, subconscious mind. In this citta, which is an informational pool, more or less can be compared with the hard drive, hard disk in our computer, all the impressions from the past are stored in this memory. So then, according to the impressions which are there, and these impressions are not stored chaotically. The impressions are stored in the citta or in the hard drive of our memory or in subconscious mind with certain tags. It can be plus, it can be plus, plus, plus. It can be minus. The mind basically works according to this plus minus. It's 0-1. As any computer. Any computer works according to this 0-1, 0-1, 0-1. Plus minus. I like, I don't like. It's good, it's bad. So, the people who have psychological disorders, they have a lot of negative impressions in the mind, and practically, and it really depends, but this negativity, which is a result of their own improper interaction with the environment, ultimately, this negativity, whatever information the senses bring, they bring to the mind goes to citta, and it creates, agitates or turns on negative samskaras. And these negative samskaras, negative impressions, negative memories come back to the mind. And the mind becomes, you know, starts panicking. Ultimately, what the psychological disorder means? The psychological disorder means that our reaction to external environment is not adequate. For example, you know, I go to the lift, and and I become fearful. And every normal human being goes to the lift and he's not fearful. But because I have claustrophobia, you know, I become fearful. The fear becomes triggered by this act of going into some space, which is closed space. Why the fear is there? Because there is some negative reaction, very strong negative reaction,
stored in my consciousness. Some negative memory, which is there, and this negative memory creates totally inadequate reaction to the environment. You know, I become fearful, I become hysterical, I become this and that. So, of course, you know, it depends which case you take, but from case to case, if you give a very general description, that the general description is that the psychological disorder means too much negativity, which is stored in the mind. And this negativity is again a result of improper use of our mind. When we lived improperly, when we interacted improperly, we created a lot of negative samskaras, a lot of negative impressions. And these negative impressions in turn makes us, our mind or our reactions are very negative. Did I answer your question?
Yeah, I'm asking that how could we get over this tamas and rajas? And how could we get this sattva by being in such an environment? Because we cannot leave everything and go somewhere and do sadhana. Like you suggested that get up early in the morning, so what else are they about we can follow?
I live in Moscow, and I can tell you that Moscow is much more difficult place than Bangalore. Half of the year it's cold and dark there. Believe me, it's quite namask when it's cold and dark. There's 15 million people, 15 million Rajasic people living in Moscow. Somehow I maintain my sattvic environment around me. It really depends on your desire. If you're committed to this, if you understand that this is important, then you will be able to do it. You know, you go to bed earlier, what's the big deal? Try to do it as early as possible.
Because whenever like we do puja and all that time, it is okay. But whenever you come in the outer environment, those things dies down. So how could we overcome all that?
See, if you have certain amount of sattva inside, then you become resistant to this rajasic and tamasic influences to a certain extent.
That is not there. That consistency is not there. We are not resistant to that. How could we overcome the situation? Because we want that only.
Start with something. You know, what you want to say to me that you cannot do anything? You can. You can improve your association, can you?
Yeah, we can, but we're not able to. That's why I'm asking you. What we can do to overcome that?
The first and most important influence upon our mind is association. Because what happens with our mind, when we associate with the mind of other people, their ambitions gets into our mind. When we associate with other people, we constantly exchange with our desires and our ambitions. So if you associate with people who have sattvic ambitions, so to speak, who want to have some more sattvic kind of structure of their mind, then you also get more strong in this desire. What happens with us, we have certain desires and these desires are very strong. And what you're asking is that, you know, we're dealing with desires which are already there, how to overcome these desires. But for that we have good intelligence, and intelligence is there to explain to us what is good, what is bad. Pythagoras said a very good thing. It's a very important wisdom which he left for us. He said, choose the best and the habit will make it pleasurable. See, this is a very important motto. We have certain habits and these habits are there and it's very difficult to overcome these habits. But ultimately, if we choose good things and we develop good habits, these good habits will make these good things pleasurable for us. You know, like for example, I was a student and for me it was very difficult to get up at 7 o'clock in the morning. I usually would get up at 10 o'clock in the morning. That was my normal time. Now if I sleep more than, you know, no matter when I go to bed, I cannot sleep after 5 o'clock in the morning. Just cannot. Because I'm used to it. I like to get up early. I developed a habit, and therefore Pythagoras said, choose the best, and the habit will make it pleasurable. We'll turn it into something nice and
which you will really like.
So by your intelligence, you choose what is good, and then you work on developing the habit. Did I answer your question?
Thank you.
I want to ask three questions. The first was asked by him. Why is like tamas and rajas are there? Like if these things are more, like they are dominating the sattva, how could you increase the sattva? One question. And then because this tamas and rajas are dominating, could not be able to like increase this sattva. And second one is this food also influences the mind. What kind of food, like if you take vegetarian and non-vegetarian, is there any role of non-vegetarian to like decrease sattva and like that?
Okay.
And one more thing is sleep. We need, if you have a good sleep, then only you can do things well, like you will be so active. And some people can sleep like 3-4 hours and they could able to achieve good sleep. Some people cannot able to achieve it. And in this the sleep thing only, what else one more is? During sleep we will get some dreams. Is it good to get the dreams or not?
Okay. Thank you. Good questions. So the first question is, if you already have a lot of tamas and rajas in your mind, what to do, right? Basically, as I said, we may have a certain, you know, amount of tamas and rajas already from our upbringing, from our environment. But as a human being, we have buddhi. That's why I ended my lecture. One of the main points of my lecture, or last points of my lecture, was that we can analyze ourselves from the outside. If we only live inside the mind and only listen the impetus or influences which are there in the mind, then there is no way to get out of it. But we have the ability to see from the outside, from different perspectives, to estimate what is there and to see is it good or not. And this ability is the ability which gives us buddhi, as I said, or introspection. If we develop it gradually, we will be able to manage it. You know, of course, if you already have certain makeup of the mind, it's difficult to manage because there is already very strong tendencies in the mind itself. But still you can do it. For that, you have to go out of the mind and look at the mind from the, you know, external perspective. And this we can do. Anyone can do. We can analyze ourselves. We can see, is it good or is it bad? And we can gradually start developing something good, you know. Any one of us can do it. Any one of us can chalk out a program which will help us to increase sattva in the mind. In Bhagavad Gita it is explained that there's three modes of nature, tamas, rajas and sattva. They're in constant fighting with each other. And if we already have too much tamas and rajas in our mind, then we can start gradually increasing sattva, and sattva will push out tamas and rajas. There is a good story that in our heart there are two dogs living. One is the black dog, another one is the white dog. And they are fighting with each other. And the white dog is good, and the black dog is bad. And they live in the same heart, right? And they are always fighting with each other. So the question is, which dog will win at the end? Who can answer?
The one which we wish for.
The one which you feed the more.
Right?
If you starve one dog, the other dog will win. So it really depends what qualities inside you are feeding. And to determine which qualities you are feeding, you have your intelligence. You know, you have to manage your life according to your intelligence, and by managing your life according to your intelligence, you try to increase certain positive tendencies, and this
positive tendencies will push out the negative tendencies. I answered your question. Second question about the sleep. That's again very much connected with the whole topic of sattva, rajas and tamas. If in our mind there is a lot of rajas or a lot of tamas, of course, if there is a lot of tamas, then you need a lot of sleep, because this is the makeup of your mind. Sometimes you need 12 hours of sleep or, you know, 14 hours of sleep, because you're just sleeping. This is the nature, this is your nature. Napoleon, he used to say that the man needs 6 hours to sleep, the women need 7 hours to sleep, and the fools need more. And he very much intimates to this. It's the same idea. It's his own understanding or his own experience. You know, if you're a fool, and tamas means you're foolish, you are retarded, you are too much into this, engrossed into the ignorance. So you need a lot of sleep. And you don't, of course, you don't see any dreams, or you might see some dreams, but... So if you have a lot of rajas in yourself, you're very agitated and you're very excited and, you know, a lot of this passionate energy is within your mind, then again, you need a longer sleep, because when you sleep, you don't sleep. The mind don't get rest. And basically this passionate energy gives you a lot of dreams. You dream, and you know, every one of us knows, when you dream a lot, you don't really rest at night. You're just dreaming and you get up and you're more tired than before. Because of these endless dreams. But these dreams is, this betrays that there is a lot of passion within our mind, and therefore we cannot sleep peacefully. So if sattva is there, if the mind is basically sattvic, then you go to bed very easily, you sleep peacefully, and you need less sleep. As I said, Napoleon said that the normal man needs only 6 hours to sleep. And I know if you increase sattva, the advantage of this is that you will need less and less sleep. 4 hours to sleep is not a big achievement. It's an easy achievement if sattva is predominant in your mind, basically. And this is about sleep. And the second question was about food. And I think the answer is obvious, because if you consider the origin of the food, you know, obviously the fruits, the grains, especially when they're natural, when they're without too much chemicals, they are very sattvic. This is sattvic energy. They carry sattvic energy. If you kill animals, it's definitely not very sattvic. The pain which the animal experiences being killed, especially if it's a highly developed animal, is there in the meat. And it definitely influences your mind in a very negative way. When you eat meat, this is the most negative point about eating meat. When you eat grains, then your mind is very peaceful, basically. But meat contains a lot of toxins, a lot of a lot of fear. When you animal knows perfectly well that you will kill him, and this fear, which is there in the mind of the animal, produces certain hormones. We know as soon as we have this fearful reaction, the hormones are being produced, and the hormones are being infused in our blood immediately. And of course, pain is also there, pain connected with the killing of this animal. So it also produces certain hormones, and these all hormones are there in the blood. Like in Judaism, they say that you can eat meat, but you cannot eat the blood. Because in the blood you have all these negative things, fear and pain of the animal. But my simple question is that how you can eat meat without eating the blood? You cannot. And if you see, if you study any religion, you will see that any religion will give some restriction to the meat eating. I don't know any religion which restricts eating carrots. You know, there is not a single religion which says that you should not eat carrot. But there is any religion, if it's Muslim religion, Jewish religion, Hinduism, Christianity, they all say avoid meat on certain days. But my question is, if the meat is bad on Friday, why it is good on Thursday? Where is the logic here? So, obviously again, because religion is there. Originally, religion is there to protect the mind. And therefore, religion always restricts meat-eating. Because unrestricted meat-eating negatively affects the mind. It gives very bad tendencies to the mind, increases the energy of rajas and tamas in the mind. And therefore, simple solution is to eat carrot and not eat meat.
Did I answer your question? Yes.
So, in the start of your presentation, when you explained that Namalata studied the kids of 4 years old.
Yes.
And these 4 years old kids were able to heal their gratification.
Yes.
And over a period of 20 or 25 years of research, these found to be the successful people who have whatever the way they have defined. So, what I feel is kids, when they were 4 years old, there were some innate qualities in them which has helped them to be successful in their life,
yes,
rather than the other kids.
Yes.
So, through these right practices, yoga and being sattvic, one can train the mind.
Yes.
But can it lead to the evolve? Can it be an evolved mind? If these two things are same, or the purpose of life to be being evolved, or just to be trained, only the right practices?
I'm not 100% sure if I understood you properly, but as far as I can understand, what you mean to say is that, yes, kids have innate properties in them, and therefore I said that there are four influences, or four main factors which influence our mind from the beginning. And I explained environment. I explained action a little bit, how that our actions influence our mind, but there is our karma. So these innate properties in the kids are partially from the past life. And when we are talking about evolution of the mind, we're basically talking about this. You know, whatever you do by investing some positive energy into your mind stays with the mind. According to Bhagavad Gita, when the soul leaves the body, he leaves the body with the mind. And the impressions which are there in the mind, samskaras, are taken with us. And therefore, the memories of our previous experiences are there in some form in this previous, in this present life. You know, basically we have some fears, we have some subconscious structures, so to speak, and this is carried from life to life. And the evolution of the mind means to get the good samskaras, very positive samskaras, which ultimately will bring our mind, sattvic samskaras, which ultimately will bring our mind to another state. And yoga says that there are different samskaras, and it is said that there are some material samskaras. And of them, of course, sattvic samskaras are the best. But yoga also says that there are some spiritual samskaras, which remain all the time with the mind, and which are very powerful. They carry certain spiritual energy, which is there in the mind, and this spiritual energy will definitely manifest in its next life and bring us to the next stage. In Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, Neha Vikramana Shasti Pratyavayana Vidyate Svalpama Pyasya Dharmasya Trayata Mahato Bhayata. It says, whatever you achieved in your previous life, in your spiritual development, will be there with you in the next life. So the evolution of the mind is continuous, and the sattvic in the environment and the sattvic mind will bring you to have very harmonious and peaceful and happy life in this life, but it also will increase your proclivity or your inclination for spiritual practices and will bring about spiritual impressions which will ultimately lead you to some higher evolution. Did I answer your question?
Yeah. Basically, I feel that different people, when they born, they differently evolved.
Yes.
And these samskara, as we live through the life,
yes,
it lead to a higher growth.
Yes.
Or like self-actualization. Yes. Not all of us can reach self-actualization, but these are the tools which can lead to a higher growth.
Ultimately, yes. And therefore, I said that this certain philosophy which I mentioned, Viktor Frankl, or certain, not certain philosophy, certain psychological school of psychology, says that the real self-actualization or real self-realization is possible only when you have the meaning of life and when you increase sattvic influences, then the spiritual practices will come along with it and will ultimately bring about self-actualization and happiness in a real sense. Because you will feel fulfillment of your inner calling.
Please, no more questions now, because we have some questions for you.
So, we are extremely grateful to His Holiness Bhaktivinoda and Goswami Maharaj for his profound and very systematic presentation on the role of the mind in our personal development. So, just to keep your, just to test your, the awareness that you had in the talk, I have five questions and the corresponding gifts to share. So the first question is, as you know, the presentation starts, and please raise your hand so that there's no conflict, so that I can just decide on who can answer. So the first question is, His Holiness brought up the concept of deferred gratification at the beginning of the talk, and he explained it through an experiment that was conducted. So I need to know the person who conducted, the name of the experiment, and the university from which the person came from. Anybody? So there's only one hand. Okay, I guess I saw your hand first, you can try to answer.
Marshmallow experiment and Daniel
Michael
and
Sam was
the
university. So I guess you probably get a joint prize. You can come and collect it from His Holiness on the test.
Yes.
Second question is, mention the four properties of mind that was presented in the discussion. Four properties. Actually, that's quite a description of the mind. Not a property. Maybe you can try.
It's malleable.
Uh-huh.
It's influenced by environment, action, and it can be changed. It's like malleable.
Yeah. Yeah. Mostly. Basically, he mentioned four points. As firstly, it's malleable or pliable. Secondly, it has a form.
Right.
Third, you mentioned about the influences that it can have, the environment, upbringing, karma, and actions. And fourth, he said, you can change your mind. Right? That's very important. It's not that we have given this body or mind we have at birth. We have the ability to change. So please come forward to that. Third question. So explain the similarity in definition that of an object and that of a mind. I guess you probably answered, but still you can clarify, explain it properly so that you can.
Any object has three main characteristics which define it. It's mass, energy and structure, where mass is like quite static, whereas very sensitive to change would be energy and most would be structure. Similarly, the mind has three, so can be described in three properties, that is mass, energy and structure, when the structure is the most sensitive and it should be changed, and also the energy, whereas the mass would be, therefore you have three terms, that is tamas, rajas and sattva.
Perfect. So please come forward to connect you. Fourth question, mention the four influences upon the mind in our day-to-day life. Four influences, preferably with its Sanskrit terms, so that it's more authentic. Four influences upon our mind in our day-to-day
life. Kala, place and distance.
Perfect. Ahara, that is food and drink. Kala, that is time. Place, that is where we can stay, and association, that's whom we deal with. Please come forward. And the final question. So what are the impetuses in human psychology that have been propounded through various theories? And explain the propounder. I mean, you mentioned the propounder also, and the result. I guess I would like to give it to another person. The one, the late girl name.
The Sigmund Freud's pleasure principles in Alfred Adler's Power and Status. Victor Frankl's Meaning of Life.
And what is the result of each? No, what is the result? What is the end result? If a person aspires for enjoyment based on Sigmund Freud's philosophy, what is the result?
Depression.
And in case of Adler, what's the result? Frustration. And finally, in case of Frankl, it will be happiness. Please come.
You please come.
So, we are extremely grateful for your patient audience and enthusiastic participation in the quiz as well. So, to make some couple of announcements, before that, we want to sincerely thank Hindi Samiti. They've been our best friends in campus in the sense of being cooperative and affording us this opportunity to conduct such seminars on a regular basis. So, we are very, very thankful. A round of applause for them. So the announcements are, as the discussion happened, we actually have a weekly talk on Sundays from 10 to 11, elaborating on various principles of the Gita and trying to help each of us implement certain concepts that are given in the Gita that can further make our progress towards Sattva and even beyond. And especially this coming week, we are having this semester's first or the seminar giving an overview on the Gita. Okay. It will be a four-hour seminar. It will be conducted over four sessions of 45 minutes each. There will be lunch at the end. It will be a multimedia presentation. So I would request you to fill up the registration form if you are interested. Next Sunday, 10 to 2. So you don't have to, I understand your mess timings are around 12:30. But we will end it with a lunch at the seminar itself, so you don't have to kind of worry you miss your mess timings. So I urge you to attend that so that you get a complete understanding of the principles of the Gita, so that you have a more comprehensive understanding of what the discussion was to be all about. And subsequently, every week we do have talks on certain themes from the Gita, so that also you are welcome to attend. And you can attend the, you can visit the website that I mentioned in the beginning. It's even the registration form also, absolutetruth.in. It will have a, it has a volume of, it has volumes of topics and discussions on various contemporary issues as well as theological issues. So with this, we once again want to thank His Holiness for his precious time, because actually he came here for a very specific task of inaugurating a hospital in Marathali, which was done yesterday, and he has to leave tomorrow back to Moscow. So he was here on a very short visit of just 3 days, and just on a phone call he agreed to give this talk, and it was, I'm sure all of us benefited from it. So once again, a final round of applause for him.
Before ending this program, I would like to thank Swamiji for accepting our invitation and giving such a mesmerizing talk about how to control our mind. I would like to thank faculty and staff member of Choksi Hall for their generous cooperation. I acknowledge the effort put by all Hindi Samiti members and ABDM members in organizing this talk, and at the end, I thank you all for coming here and joining us in this talk. Thank you.